going to be reading from Philippians chapter 2, verse 5 to 11. Let the same mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be exploited, but emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, being born in human likeness, and being found in human form, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God also highly exalted him and gave him the name that is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bend in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue should confess that Jesus is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. And God always blesses the public reading of his inspired and infallible word.
When I was three, my wife treated me to a surprise and unexpected trip to Rome. And we had a wonderful weekend in October. The weather was amazing. Wandering around the streets, visiting the churches and doing all kinds of things. And one particular night, we decided that we were going to go to hear a choir that had come to Rome to perform that weekend because we both love music. And we went into the church. There were about 1,000 people in the church. And the choir were dreadful. Every note was off key. They had clearly tried to practice moving in step, but they were bumping into each other. You name it, it was happening. And I leaned across to my wife and said, shall we sneak out at the end of the first song and go and enjoy a meal in Rome? And she said, yes, let's do that. So the song ended and we sneaked out. The problem was 800 other people sneaked out with us. It was a bad moment. And we were standing outside the church laughing at what had happened. And across the road, we were going to go for a meal to a place that we'd been before, just a couple of nights before. And across the road, under the cardboard and newspapers and old blankets, was a little family. A man and a woman and a little girl. And they were clearly homeless and hungry. And we decided that we were going to buy them a meal. And we didn't need the meal, so we were going to buy them the meal, buy them a meal. And we stepped down onto the road to go across. But just as we stepped onto the road, around the corner came two, I presume, Catholic priests or young priests in training. Each of them carrying a small leather bag. And they knelt down beside this little family in the October air. And one of them took out a book, perhaps a Bible, perhaps what's called a breviary or a prayer book or a book with prayers, and put his arm around them and started to pray with them. And they clearly knew him because they smiled and they embraced, and this was clearly not the first time that this these two young men had interacted with this young family. And the other one took out a little Primus gas stove and a tiny little pot and a Tupperware or a plastic container, for those of you that don't know what Tupperware is, a plastic container, and poured some stew or soup or something into the pot and heated it up and fed the young family. And they laughed in the October air. And my wife and I stood and wept, and our lives were changed. We've never been the same. These two young men served out of their nothing. They brought out of their poverty. I don't know whether you are aware, but the average salary, if you want to call it that, for somebody in that condition is around £3,500 or £4,000 or about $5,000. a year. And we were deeply struck by the humility of the moment. All around us this Christmas time, leaders occupy thrones of power. When they walk into rooms, they expect everybody else to stop. When they sit at tables, they expect everybody else to listen. When they speak, everyone else should be silent. From prime ministers to kings to presidents, our cultures around the world have an assumption about power and authority and kingship that demand not just obedience, but demand subservience of those that listen to them. Not so, King Jesus. Not so, King Jesus. He calls us to see him as the humble king. The king who comes, and in the words of Philippians chapter 5, empties himself. The Greek word is kenosis. It means that he strips himself of all of his rights, all of his regal standing is removed. His power is not changed, but his rights are surrendered for us. And this Christmas season, as you go through whatever you're going through, as you journey through Advent toward Christmas Eve and then Christmas Day, I want to remind you that the Jesus that I serve is a humble king. He is a servant king. In Matthew chapter 10, I beg your pardon, in Mark chapter 10, verse 45, Jesus was confronted by leaders. And this is what he said. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. When you read Matthew's account of the birth of Jesus, you can't help but notice the juxtaposition of King Herod and King Jesus. When the wise men come from afar, they go straight to Herod, King Herod. His name, King Herod, or his title, is used several times in Matthew 2 and 3. Where is the one who is born king of the Jews, they ask. And Herod, covered and surrounded by his splendor, with his minions around him and his authority and his power displayed in what he wore and where he lived and how he walked. It was said of Herod, he didn't walk anywhere. He was carried everywhere. He refused to walk. And King Herod summons the wise men, and when they say to him, where is the one that is born king of the Jews? You've heard me say before, only Jesus was born king. Nobody is born a king. People are born princes, they're not born kings. But not so Jesus. He was born king. And Herod says, where is he? He expects an answer, and the wise men don't give him that answer. Then he works out how old Jesus was. And he has all those children, all those little boys under 2 years old or under 18 months in Jerusalem butchered. Because this king will not let anyone threaten his power. He'd rather wipe out a generation than surrender his throne. Has it ever struck you that Jesus would have been one of a handful of boys from that generation? The others were all dead, murdered by power that, when threatened, turned on its own people. That's what earthly power does. When you are a threat to it, it kills you. It silences you. And all around the story of the birth of Jesus in Matthew's gospel, you have the power of the authorities around them. You have the power of the high priest. You have the power of the scribes, you have the power of Herod, you have political power and religious power and social power surrounding Jesus, whose power looks entirely different to that kind of power. Jesus uses his power not to kill people, but to save people. He uses his authority not to lock people in, but to open the prison door so that they can go free. And you see this servant-heartedness in Jesus from the beginning of his ministry until the end in the Gospel of Luke. When you read of the birth of Jesus, we are told that Mary took him and wrapped him in swaddling clothes and laid him in a manger, a stone manger, not a wooden manger, a piece of feeding trough hewn out of the rocks around Bethlehem. The first man to hold him would have been his stepfather, Joseph. Imagine the scene with me for a moment. Mary and Joseph, both poor, having traveled miles to get to Bethlehem for the census that the Romans had imposed upon the Jewish people at the time. And as the cry of that baby echoes across the Bethlehem air, probably in April or maybe September, definitely not December, they put him in a feeding trough for animals. Herod, surrounded by regalia, surrounded by wealth and power and council members, surrounded by those that are sycophants that would say, yes, Herod, do that. Yes, Herod, do that. Yes, Herod, do that. Surrounded by men who would never question him, because if they questioned him, he would die. Whereas King Jesus is surrounded by whatever animals were in that cave, surrounded by dirt, surrounded by cold air, and wrapped in rags. Humility. At the end of his life, the first man to hold him, Joseph. The last man to hold him, Joseph. But a different Joseph. Joseph of Arimathea. And we read at the end of Luke's gospel that when Jesus had died on the cross, Joseph went to Pilate and asked for his body. And he was given it. And he took it down. And we are told he was wrapped in cloths once again and placed in a stone tomb. The one that the Bible calls the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords began his earthly life in a stone manger, wrapped in rags, and ended his earthly life in a stone tomb, wrapped in burial clothes. Humility. And throughout his ministry, he evidenced this humility. When he was baptized, he went to see his cousin, John the Baptist. And John's gospel tells us that John announced him, declared him, told everybody who he was. But the gospel writers also tell us that when Jesus went to be baptized by John, John said, I should not be baptizing you. I am not even worthy to tie your sandals. And Jesus said, no, you must do it so that the scripture could be fulfilled. Humility. Everywhere he went, he demonstrated humility. In John chapter 4, he demonstrated humility when he met the woman at the well. In John chapter 8, he demonstrated humility when he knelt in the dirt to forgive the woman that the rest of Jewish society had rejected. When he was asked about what it was to be great or powerful or strong, what does leadership look like, Jesus? What does authority look like, Jesus? In Matthew 18, he called children to himself. And he said, unless you become like a little child, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. He wasn't talking about naivety. He was talking about dependence and honesty and trust and openness to God and a simple belief that God was faithful. Humility. Which of you today could explain God to me? If I was to give you the rest of your life, could you explain God to me? I have been a follower of Jesus since 1986, almost 40 years. I understand less about God than I have ever understood. My faith journey has been one into holding on to a few simple truths and letting go of a lot of prejudice. When I was first converted, in those first 4 or 5 years, I felt as if I knew God. And anybody asked me a question, I had an answer. I was the budding theologian. I was the John Calvin of Ireland. Now, 40 years on, I understand less about God than I have ever understood, but I tell you, I love him more than I have ever loved him. Because I don't need to understand God to trust him. I don't need to have all the answers. But over my life, I have discovered in the almost 40 years of following him that he is faithful. That he is gentle and gracious and kind. That he is generous of spirit. That he looks at Malcolm Duncan and he believes the best of me whilst acknowledging the worst of me. That he has made a commitment that he will never walk away, that he will never leave me, he will never forsake me, he will never abandon me. The humble king doesn't only sit in the dirt, lie in the dirt of the manger, he's not only buried in the dirt of the tomb, he sits in the dirt of my life. He comes and sits with me in my mess. He doesn't expect me to have everything sorted before he accepts me. He accepts me and sorts me. He redeems me and then he changes me. He comes to me because I could not come to him. Could there ever be a clearer example of humility than the God who comes to us? In Matthew chapter 20, James and John's mum is on a power grab. And she tells her boys to go to Jesus. And between the three of them, they say, "Will you grant that we can sit at your right hand and your left when you come and your greatness and your power and your glory?" And Jesus says, "You have no idea what you're asking. Because in my kingdom, the last will be first and the first will be last. And the greatest will be least, and the least will be greatest." You see, this Jesus who comes to us as the humble king isn't just humble in his birth. He's not just humble in his life. He's not just humble in his death. He's humble in his essence. Have you ever considered the difference in the ministries of John the Baptist and Jesus? John the Baptist was an Old Testament prophet. He was a Nazarene. He couldn't touch anything that was infected or anyone who was infected. Jesus not only touched them, he embraced them. John the Baptist couldn't go near someone who was dead. Jesus rose people from the dead. John the Baptist had to be separate from those that were considered contaminated. Jesus had dinner with them. He invited them to his table. He spent time with them. He loved them and he saw them. And he welcomed them, the humble king. What would you have done if he wasn't humble? How would you have been redeemed? How could I have been saved if God was not willing to come to me? He came to me. He came to me. In the words of that old Don Moen song, I think, when I couldn't come to where he was, he came to me. That's why he died on Calvary. When I was in my late 20s, I was pastoring in a church for just a year in Somerset, in Yeovil, where they have lovely apples. That's a West Country accent if you missed it. And a young man came to our church called Matthew, who was addicted to heroin. And there was nobody in the community at the time that was able to offer him accommodation, so he came to live with my wife and I. He was wonderful. And one night, our treasurer had a barbecue and said to me, "Would you like to bring Matthew?" And I said, "I'd love to." So Matthew and I were bundled into a blue Cavalier hatchback that somebody had given me. It was falling apart, but I thought I was the king of the road. I mean, this Cavalier, you know, it had a horn, the lights worked, the brakes worked. You think, isn't that all cars? That wasn't then. We went to the barbecue and we came back. We had the most wonderful evening. And on the way back, Matthew was sitting in the front beside me. We were driving back to our house. And he said, "Matthew, Malcolm, for the first time in my life, I feel like I'm part of a family. I feel like I found a community that will accept me." And I turned to Matthew to say thank you and to tell him that I was glad he was in our lives. And that little shebang of a blue Cavalier filled with light. And for 30 or 45 seconds, Jesus was sitting beside me in my car, looking at me through the eyes of a drug addict. I pulled over and I couldn't speak. The humble king, who didn't only come to Matthew and rescue him, he came and took up residence in his life. You see, when you look at the eyes of those around you, what do you see? Trouble, hassle, difficulty. But what does God see? Matthew died a few days later. A young pharmacist misprescribed him his methadone replacement program and gave him 10 times more than he was due to have. His mother and father came to Yeovil to collect his body. And I met them. And they said, "How was the last few days of his life?" They said, "Matthew was a very troubled young man. They'd lost all contact with him. We hope he found peace." And I said, "Oh, he did. He found peace. And he found hope. And he found love. And he found joy." Why did he find those things? Because the humble king came to live in him. Sisters and brothers, let me ask you a question. It's a simple question. It's not complicated. If you needed God to be humble, to come to you, if you needed him to step into your life, if you needed him to see past all the difficulties and mistakes and hurdles and regrets that you had erected, so that you could be redeemed, what do you think those around us need? They need us to demonstrate the same humility. Because if he demonstrated it to us, he called us to demonstrate it to others. On the night that he was betrayed, he not only took bread and broke it, he left the table and he wrapped a towel around his waist and he took a basin and he washed the feet of his disciples, including Judas, the one who would betray him. And then he looked at his disciples. It's recorded in John 13. And he said, "Do you understand what I have done? You must go and do likewise."